In a world where action films are dumped in theaters and TV, dead on arrival.
I can't go on living this lie!
You need a hero.
Last time I trusted someone, I lost an eye.
You need a helper.
Hello, hello, nothing to see here.
You need a healer.
That is affirmative.
You need...
We're on the air.
Professor Rick's Action Film Autopsy.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Professor Rick's Action Film Autopsy. I am your host, Professor Rick. Rick Myers, actually. Actually, I was a professor. And I still am, I guess I'm a professor. But I was an official professor for a while at a university. But that's neither here nor there. I'll start with our theme song. Here we go. There'll be spoilers. 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 We want these films to be better, so there will be spoilers. And normally, this is the moment where I would say, and here are my two co-critics, my co-hosts, and then Miko would say, hi, I'm Miko, and Jen would say, hi, I'm Jen, but they're not here. It is post-New York Comic Con, and those amateurs, those punks, can't go to a simple New York Comic Con without getting sick. They're sick today, and things are such that they can't record this podcast any other time this week. So for, I believe, the first time ever in the 30 episodes, and this is the 30th episode of Professor Rick's Action Film Autopsy, I am alone in my office recording this podcast. Ooh, I'm scared. This is going to be terrible. Well, I hope you'll bear with me. You know, it was the New York Comic Con. Before we get into the movies this week, or at least some of the movies, because this is the fall down episode, it's autumn, and this is where, not quite as much as in August and September, is where action movies go to die, or at least in this case, kind of wither away, or sort of make a little introduction to the fall and especially the winter and the holiday season. And as you well know, if you have visited any of your nearby stores, nobody's waiting even to November or Thanksgiving to decorate Christmas like it's the holiday, like it's the Christmas season, it's the Kwanzaa season, it's the Hanukkah season. Everybody's decorating it now at the beginning of October. So you know that everybody's getting ready. So we got the big holiday films coming up. I'm looking forward to the big holiday films. But in the meantime, we have to deal with October fall down movies. But like I said, before we get into that, because it's the New York Comic Con and my co-host's youthful health situation. They're youthful, but they're not healthy. It's really weird. I highly recommend Kung Fu and Tai Chi and Qigong to everyone with a good teacher, because I like to attribute it to my fine teachers, Fong Sun Li in Taiwan, Stephen Watson, Rick Barrett, I was going to say Don the Dragon Wilson, and I'll go for Don Wilson as well. They've all been very helpful in me staying healthier than even my young cohorts, thanks to Qigong and other things. That's cool. But that's not what you're here for. What you are here for is to hear about these movies, and I'm still not going to get to the movies because I wanted to talk a little bit about the New York Comic Con. As you may know, I do the superhero kung fu extravaganza at the San Diego Comic-Con, the original, that more than 40-year-old, for fans, by fans, Comic-Con. And I've been offering something similar or even things completely different to the New York Comic-Con for many years, and they want nothing to do with it. A bunch of my friends, Demetrius Angelo from the Urban Action Showcase on November 11th at the AMC Empire 25 Theater at 234 West 42nd Street. He does the Urban Action Showcase this year. We're going to have the anniversary of Spawn with Michael Jai White in attendance, as well as a film festival of the Venoms films from the Shaw Brothers, Five Deadly Venoms and Masked Avengers, and I think three to four others, with Liu Feng, the Centipede from Five Deadly Venoms, in attendance. I'm supposed to interview him. I better learn Mandarin quick. That's November 11th. So he, Demetrius Angelo, offered the New York Comic Con an action film panel or action film clips or all that stuff. They didn't want anything to do with him. Detective Chinatown 2, you can see Detective Chinatown 1 on YouTube right now. They were filming the sequel in New York, and I got to visit the set, thanks to my wonderful friend Jeannie Liu, who is the talent coordinator on that movie. And the PR person for that movie offered the New York Comic Con all sorts of things, directors, stars of these amazing movies, and the New York Comic Con didn't go for that either. The New York Comic Con is well, the way I look at it, San Diego Comic Con is for fans by fans, and the New York Comic Con is for fans by businessmen. They're kind of like the great exploitation film distributors of the past. Their attitude seems to be, like the exploitation film people, is once we get your money, we don't really care. We don't care what you want or your comfort or anything. When you first walk into the New York Comic Con at the Jacob Javits Convention Center in New York, it's beautiful. I mean, it's like this airy, open, science fiction-y kind of booming place, and it's filled with every imaginable banner and advertisement for all these entertainment television shows and video games and movies and toys and everything. As you probably all well know, there's so much, as you probably all well know, that's when I said it correctly, I just didn't phrase it the way I liked it. There's so much entertainment now, there's no way of keeping up. There's just, people are telling me all the time, well, you got to check out this show, you got to check out that show. And it's not just on television, but of course it's on Amazon and Hulu and Netflix, and it's all over the place. And it's all pretty darn good. A lot of it is pretty darn good. And I'm never at a loss for entertaining things to see, but it's kind of like too much. You can't keep up. You have to do it 24 hours a day in order to keep up with it all. So the New York Comic Con fills your eyes with everything when you walk in, and it's open and it's airy and it's sunny. And then you go onto the actual floor, the show floor, which is where everybody is hawking their wares and advertising their stuff and selling stuff. And it's huge and expansive, but at the same time, it's not. It's dark and it's kind of looming over you. Even though I know that the ceiling is pretty high, the effect is that you're inside an ant farm. And I was trying to figure out why it was so oppressive. And because there's a lot of space, but the space doesn't seem to be space that's used to make you feel good. It's the ant farm kind of feeling. But also I noticed that the air, people were complaining that there wasn't enough air conditioning. And I didn't feel hot, but I did feel as if the air was not moving. It was stagnant air, which creates sort of a pressure on you. It's the San Diego Comic-Con is kind of like the Star Trek reboot. It's all shiny and hopeful and bright. And the New York Comic-Con is kind of like Alien Covenant. It's dark and hateful. If you saw Dunkirk, Christopher Nolan's Dunkirk, there's two scenes inside the holds of ships. And he does a brilliant job of making it claustrophobic and oppressive and sort of gives the impression that he's sealing you in. That's what the New York Comic Con was like. The Artist Alley. They had some of the greatest artists in the comic industry and advertising and cartoons of all time there. And they were crammed into this space that normally would seem fairly large, although that was very clearly low-ceilinged. But with all the fans in there and all the artists, I mean hundreds and hundreds of artists, crammed in there, it felt like both of the Dunkirk ship's holds about to be attacked by U-boats and sunk. I wanted to visit friends of mine. After a couple of minutes, I could not stand it. It's really weird. I can't wait to go to San Diego Comic-Con, but I can't wait to leave the New York Comic-Con. But it was fun. I will say that it's fun. I met a lot of terrific people. The webmaster here at the podcast, this is a podcast, right? Yeah. The webmaster for my website of actionfilmautopsy.com and the podcast itself, he was going to go, he runs this thing called Pop Culture Upload, which goes to, I think, 140 radio stations and also the audio channels of JetBlue. And he was going to go and interview a bunch of television show casts, new television show casts, but because of some problems, I mean, he has, not him, but his family has health issues, like my co-host Jen and Miko, guys, come on now. I'll teach you some Qigong. So he couldn't go, so he sent me. That's why I went at all. Normally, I wouldn't have gone. I've already been there. But he asked me to go, and I got to meet the casts and interview the cast of Stand Against Evil on IFC and Reverie, the upcoming NBC show, and Freeform Siren about a very angry mermaid, very beautiful, but very angry. And what was the other? Oh, yeah, the Chronicles of Shannara, which has moved from MTV to Spike TV. And that was all cool. But the best thing that happened, as far as I was concerned, is I was meeting the producer and the publicity person for Detective Chinatown 2 at the one decent restaurant in the Jacob Javits Convention Center area, which is Friedman's Lunch, and which is a really nice and a really delicious farm-to-table place, because that, to me, is the ultimate kind of New York experience. And while I'm waiting for them to show up and for the table to be ready, in walks Bill from Doctor Who. Why am I blanking on her name? Of course I'm blanking on her name, because I'm doing a recording of the podcast. So, of course, I completely forget her wonderful name. I'm going to pause this and find out her name, because that's pathetic. Hold on. Pearl Mackey. Her name is Pearl Mackey. Of course it's Pearl Mackey. Well, I can't, but anyway, you don't want to know. And when I start recording stuff, I can't remember the word "the" half the time. I'm lucky to have thought of it just then. But anyway, Pearl Mackey walks into the restaurant with nobody, you know, no guards, no PR people, no BBC people. And I'm going, what are you doing without guards? And she just looked at me like, yeah, I'm at Comic-Con. So she gave me a selfie. I'll put it up in the supplementals. And that was, to me, that was the highlight. And also was outside of the actual convention center. Once you're in that convention center, you can't wait to get out. But enough about that. Let's get to the movies. Well, and here we are on the Fall Down episode. So I guess the first one, I can choose whichever one I want. I don't even have to ask Jen or Miko, those recuperating. Get well soon, guys. Hopefully they will be back on the episode after next. The next one will be an interview episode as usual, and then we'll go back to our reviews. Ooh, we got some good stuff coming up, but we got some stuff here now too. I don't know how good it is, but we have some stuff. And let's start with Kingsman: The Golden Circle, which is a sequel to Kingsman, which is an adaptation of a graphic novel, comic book slash whatever, called The Secret Service by Mike Millar and Dave Gibbons, both very talented gentlemen. And it's directed by Matthew Vaughn, written by Jane Goldman, who's Jonathan Ross's wife, and Matthew Vaughn. And it's a sequel to their original, surprisingly successful, surprising to the producers and pretty much everybody, original Kingsman, The Secret Service. And it's really super interesting that I liked Kingsman, The Secret Service, the original. I didn't love it because at the end of the movie, which often happens with Matthew Vaughn movies for me, it kind of falls apart. This happened with Kick-Ass as well. I don't even want to talk about Kick-Ass 2. But interesting, wait a minute now, I will talk about Kick-Ass 2 because it just occurred to me that Kingsman 2, Kingsman the Golden Circle, the sequel, and Kick-Ass 2 both have the same problem. The original Kick-Ass was pretty darn good until the ending. And Kingsman the Secret Service, the original, was pretty darn good until the ending. And in both cases, at the end of the movie, the characters start to unravel. They start to come apart. They start acting unlike they have for the rest of the film. In the case of Kick-Ass, we had that wonderful character played by Grace Moretz, who is just a really hit girl, who's really awesome at fighting, and suddenly at the very end of the movie, she just completely falls apart in terms of being able to fight. She forgets everything that she's shown you that she knows for the first three quarters, five, six of the movie, and just turns into somebody completely different, and then is saved by the hero, Kick-Ass, in a way that is not really credible within the context of the rest of the film. And what happened with Kingsman was that the character sort of maintained a credibility throughout most of the film, but at the end of the film, things just started to get goofy. Things just started coming in from left field and right field and center field, and it was like, oh yeah, if you can accept the silliness of this and the kind of outside the movie humor. I've always said that good James Bond movies is when James Bond does not become a reckless endangerment to public safety. The villains are reckless endangerments to public safety. That's a good James Bond film. And also a good James Bond film, actually a good any film, has humor from inside the movie. In other words, it comes from character and situations. When, as in Moonraker, you have a double-taking pigeon, that is not humor that you see in real life. That's humor that's created by the filmmakers just to be goofy, and it destroys the credibility for me in the film. I like humor from inside the film, not from outside the film. And what was happening in both Kick-Ass, at the end of the original Kick-Ass and the original Kingsman, was that at the very end, they start having humor from outside the movie. They start sort of like winking at the camera, saying, oh, we're just having fun. And I thought that was an aberration. But now I realize, because it was the same thing in Kick-Ass 2, that happens in Kingsman, The Golden Circle, which is apparently, since Kick-Ass was a success, so they got a sequel, and Kingsman was a success, so they got a sequel. It turns out that little end piece is actually what they wanted to do for the entire movie, because the entire Kingsman, The Golden Circle, is just like the end of the original Kingsman. It is goofiness supreme. It is, let's just do this for the heck of it. Let's just put this in because I want to. Not because it makes sense, not because it's credible, not because it's believable from within the context of what I've created before. It's just, we're just going to have fun. And, you know, it's what I call a masturbatory movie. There's an old joke that somebody doesn't watch porno because when he's hungry, he doesn't watch the film of a steak. But at the same time, there's certain kind of films which are like really good sex. It's just the director is having really good sex with the film. And, you know, and it's kind of like you can really admire it because you can put yourself in the director's position. Unfortunately, if the director is just doing masturbation, if they're just doing cinematic masturbation, then that's kind of, you know, oh, I don't want to watch you masturbate. no. And that's what was the way I felt in Kingsman, The Golden Circle. And another great example of that is Sucker Punch, Zack Snyder's clearly masturbatory movie where you're not enjoying watching him masturbate. So that's what was happening here. Anyway, that's not the least of the problems. That's one of the major problems in this movie, because when you have a masturbatory movie and anything goes, it's not, as I've made it fairly clear, it is not very enjoyable for me personally, and I would imagine for a lot of people who have gone to it. Another thing that I've often said, and is often a result of these kind of films, is when anything is possible, nothing is interesting. It's when there are no rules and they can do whatever they want to at any time, it becomes less and less involving for me as an audience member. But that is especially true of the action. This is another example of what I'm going to find a better name for it, but I'm calling it physiology-free fighting. It joins Atomic Blonde and The Villainous and Hardcore Henry and other films and filmmakers who are trying to find a floating film equivalent to video games, to first-person shooters and fighting video games, where nobody feels anything, there's no real pain, and there's also no real biology or physiology. I mean, people are punched and kicked and devastated by energy blasts in such a way that you, that yeah, they'll lose and, you know, you win, says the video game, but you don't have a sense that anything real, human, is going on behind the scenes. And all these films are trying to create the video equivalent, because they're saying, well, video games are hugely successful, so we want to be hugely successful too, so we want to cater to the video game player. But as I often point out, the video game player already has video games. You go in a very private, it's one thing to see a movie. It's another thing to play a video game. And as a person who doesn't play a lot of those kind of video games, I play, you know, really childish video games on my computer, you know, basically Match 3, Candy Crush kind of things. I watch my friends play these other really amazing Assassin's Creed type of video games, and it is certainly not at all the same kind of experience as going to a good movie, because a video game doesn't demand emotional involvement. A lot of the people who are making movies like The Villainous and Atomic Blonde and apparently Kingsman, the Golden Circle, think it's the future to make these kind of physiology-free fight films. But since, like so much empty movement, like you would see in the Star Wars prequels, and it's just time-filling screen action, since it doesn't engage the audience member on a mental or emotional level. It's just empty calorie eye candy that you just sit and stare at. I shouldn't say you. I just sit and stare at. I don't feel anything. I don't think anything. It is just eye candy and ultimately just time wasting. It's not, I actually don't even mind time filling, but this is kind of time wasting, and it isn't completely time-wasting in The Kingsman, The Golden Circle, but everything in that movie seems to serve the jokes that Matthew Vaughn and Jane Goldman want to tell. I think for me, the real break in that film, the moment that made it or broke it, is that there's an extensive sequence using a gondola. It's very much on Her Majesty's Secret Service-like, where the heroes are swinging down on a Gone Wild gondola. It's also like Where Eagles Dare, which has also a wonderful gondola sequence. And other James Bond movies, again, Moonraker has the gondola sequence. So it's swinging down, it's going wild, and it's crashing onto the mountain, and it's sliding down the mountain. It's threatening an old age home at the base of the mountain, of all things, an old age home. And a bunch of elderly folk are sitting outside watching this gondola car come sliding down toward them, and it stops just in the nick of time, thanks to our hero throwing the other hero into a broken window and pulling the ripcord of a parachute. Up until that moment, the audience didn't know the other character had. It's like the parachute at the beginning of The Spy Who Loved Me, the James Bond movie, where suddenly a parachute comes out and it's got the British Union Jack emblazoned on the parachute. I believe because this is a statesman who's the American equivalent of the Kingsman, he had an American flag on his parachute. But his parachute slows the gondola enough so it stops just before hitting the old people. And one old person turns to the other old person and says, "That's the best shit I've had in weeks." Because he was so scared that he crapped his pants. Okay, not a terrible joke. Not a bad joke. Would anybody in life, outside of this movie, ever say something like that at that moment? He might say it later after they're dealing with the shock and the relief. But that's what this movie is like. And when I saw the joke, I sort of went, okay, yeah, all right. I see what you're doing here. I don't appreciate it, but I see what you're doing here. Also, there's other issues. I mean, it's like that parachute that came out of no place that no one had alluded to prior to it being used in the film. Everything's coming out of everywhere in this film. And they have the Statesmen, which are the American versions of the Kingsmen. And they have a wonderful group of actors who play the Kingsmen, predominantly Channing Tatum and Jeff Bridges is the head of Statesman, and they're kind of wasted. They're kind of introduced, they're used in a couple of cameos, and then they disappear. And, all right, well, that's kind of like Kingsman. There you go. Kingsman, the Golden Circle. It's going to be fine on a plane. It'll be fine probably on your computer screen. It'll probably be fine on your iPad or any other tablet you might have. Fine. Not great. I hope you didn't pay for it. But, oh yeah, oh, also let me tell you that another reason that I was a little disappointed is that Bradley James Allen, as he's credited in the film, was the stunt coordinator, which surprised the crap out of me, because that's Brad Allen. Brad Allen was one of Jackie Chan's Western stunt, part of the Western stuntman team. Well, he was a Westerner who was part of the Jackie Chan stuntman team. And he's awesome. Brad, if you see him in the Jackie Chan movies that he was in, like Who Am I and others, I'll put, of course, his credits on the supplemental. He's really, really good. And he's done some very nice work as a fight coordinator. But here he's the stunt coordinator. And a gentleman named Guillermo Guizmo, G-U-I-L-L-E-R-M-O, Guillermo, is that right? Yeah, like I can hear you reply. Yeah, shout at your listening device. Yeah, Rick, that's right. Or Rick, that's wrong. See, this is when I miss Jen and Miko. And so that's his first name, Grispo, G-R-I-S-P-O, is the fight coordinator. And he's been a stunt person in more things than he's been a fight coordinator for. He was in Wonder Woman and in Riddick as a stunt person. Anyway, all right, there you go. There's the credits. Now let's go on. You think Kingsman: The Golden Circle was bad? You think that was disappointing to me? Not as disappointing as the Lego Ninjago movie. Oh my goodness. I enjoyed the Lego movie. I enjoyed the Lego Batman movie. I thought I should. The odds were good that I would enjoy the Lego Ninjago movie. Directed by Charlie Bean, Paul Fisher, and Bob Logan. All of them, this is their first time as film directors. Charlie Bean worked on SpongeBob and Powerpuff Girls. Paul Fisher was the layout artist on Tiny Toons and Animaniacs. Bob Logan was the story artist on Madagascar. This was their promotion to the director's chair. This was their shot. They should have taken their shot. They did not. And the first hint that something was seriously wrong is when they credited the writers. Normally, in movies, dozens of people write them. I mean, it's extremely rare that one or two people write a movie. Usually one person writes it, then the script is handed to somebody else and handed to somebody else and handed to somebody else, then the director comes on and he wants a rewrite, and then the actors come on and they want a rewrite, and new producers come on and they want a rewrite, and the studio wants rewrites. So usually we in the audience do not get to see the sheer number of people who are writing these movies. But in the case of Lego Ninjago, if that is true, Lego Ninjago had to be written by dozens, if not hundreds, of people, because the people they credited on screen were Logan and Fisher, Paul Fisher and Bob Logan, plus William Wheeler, Tom Wheeler, Jared Stern, and John Whittington as the screenplay writers. Meanwhile, they also credit the story writers, which are Logan and Fisher again, plus Hillary Winston, Will and Tom Wheeler, and Dan and Kevin Hageman, H-A-G-E-M-A-N, however you pronounce that. So it's like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Almost a dozen people listed on screen. And meanwhile, William Wheeler wrote the live-action Ghost in the Shell, which I suppose isn't his fault. Tom Wheeler did the television show The Cape. Jared Stern did Dr. Ken, that live-action comedy on ABC, and John Whittington wrote the Lego Batman movie. So I'm sitting there going, all right, why was the Lego Batman movie so much fun and the Lego Ninjago movie was so much not fun? I realized, watching it, that Lego Batman worked because the creators had knowledge and affection for comics and pop movie culture. That movie was filled with that. And it was, there was just little sparks going off and little sparklers going off all the time in my mind. He goes, oh, yeah, yeah, I get that. Oh, yeah, that's clever. Oh, yeah, that refers to that. That's super cool. Here, however, in the Ninjago movie, the ignorance of apparently pretty much anything having to do with ninja or even pop culture, Asian pop culture, was stultifying. This movie was made to have fun with the way Americans see ninja, Japanese pop culture, and Japanese pop culture is huge and enormous, and there's so much of it, and it's all so great, and we get, you know, it filters down to us, so we know about all these different anime movies and manga movies and manga books and everything else, but nothing in this movie. The ignorance of anything to do with ninja or karate or judo or even kung fu, which is not even Japanese, because Ninjago, of course, oh, do I have to do the whole lecture about ninja? It's been fascinating to see how the original ninja, and I wrote 12 Ninja Master novels for Warner Books back in the, what, 80s and 90s or something, and I did a massive amount of research on the history of the ninja from historians, not from people who say they were ninja, not people who were teaching ninjutsu. No, I didn't find them to be particularly credible. They were making lots of lemonade out of the lemon of being a ninja, which is understandable. That's fine. I mean, right now, again, we have ninja everywhere. We have Ninjago. We have I'm blanking on the most famous Japanese show. Again, I'm going to stop this. Going to find out. I cannot believe that I blank so much. Hold on. Naruto. How can I not remember Naruto? Anyway, Naruto is a huge thing now in Japanese and American pop culture. Again, ninja. They're supposedly ninja. They're not like any ninja who actually existed in real life, because ninja were pathetic wretches who were created in order to fill the hole in the Bushido rules of honor, the way of life that the samurai lived. Let me try to say that again. Ninja filled the gap in the code of honor that samurai followed. Basically, the samurai were not allowed or didn't allow themselves to do anything dishonorable. However, they felt that if they hired someone to do something dishonorable, that was okay. Thus, the ninja were born. And the ninja were hated even by the samurai who hired them. They were hated by other people, the peons and the peasants and the farmers who were just trying to live their lives without being killed by samurai. And so everybody hated them. And basically, when they did these dishonorable things, the Bushido, the code of honor, dictated that they had no place in heaven. They wouldn't be allowed in heaven, which they weren't going to be allowed anyway because they were not samurai. So they had no place on earth and none in heaven. They were wretched, wretched people, and there are some really wonderful movies, Japanese movies, Kaga no Gunden and others, some that I even did, Shinobi no Mono, I did audio commentaries for the DVD releases, again, all on the supplementals, kids, that are really wonderful, that tell credible and historically somewhat accurate stories of ninja. But then Kaga no Gunden, which was a long-running television show with Shinichi Chiba, Sonny Chiba is how we know him, was so entertaining to so many people. It was kind of like Mighty Morphin Power Rangers for ninja. It was an awesome show and very entertaining, and people realized, oh, we like to think of ninja that way. We don't like to think of ninja as wretched losers. We like to think of them as wonderful heroes. So that's what became the norm. That's what become the norm now with Ninjago as well as Naruto and other things. So, but like I said, there's a huge amount of background that the Lego Ninjago movie could have called upon to make a wonderful entertainment in the spirit of the original Lego movie as well as Lego Batman. But they didn't do any of that. Instead, they wrote a story about a ninja father with several arms. But these are all Legos, of course. Who's attacking Ninjago to take it over, and his son, Leloid, is trying to stop him. And he's the head of the good Ninjago guys trying to stop this villain. And, okay, that's a great plot. And now bring on the comedy. Bring on the humor. Bring on the insight. Bring on the cleverness. Nope. Not having none of that. We're just going to beat this whole father-son alienation, trying to make connection to death, literally, throughout the entire film. The whole film concentrates on this turgid, very unfunny plot. And what the filmmakers apparently tried to do was they cast all these cool comics, comedians and comic actors like Fred Armisen and Kumail Nanjiani, to play the supporting ninja roles so they could riff and come up with, you know, improv, and then that would be funny, right? But of course, their riffs have nothing to do with anything on screen because they don't know, apparently, anything more about Asian pop culture and ninja and kung fu and ninja movies and fun stuff and Five Deadly Venoms or whatever than any of the filmmakers or any of the writers. So they have nothing to base their humor on other than just weird kind of comments that might work on the streets of New York, but don't work on a Lego Ninjago movie. Worse, unlike the previous two Lego movies, they waste the female characters. Female character, singular. They waste pretty much everything, replacing instead with a labored, laborious, endlessly drawn-out story of a villain father and hero son trying to make a connection. Who cares? I can tell you, and I bet if Jen and Miko were here, because they were sitting next to me when we watched this, we didn't care. Oh, man, it's not a complete loss. There is two things, actually, to look forward to if you see this, and hopefully you'll see this again on a plane or on an iPad or on your computer or on your TV, so you don't have to pay money for it, and that is, of course, Jackie Chan. Jackie Chan was hired to create the bookend, the live-action bookend in the movie, and also he was playing the voice of Master Wu. And there was a, before the Lego Batman movie, I believe, they had a short subject, which gave Jen, Miko, and myself great hope for this movie, because it was a Master Wu short subject, a short cartoon prior to the Lego Batman movie. And it was delightful and really clever, and it used Jackie's skill. Of course, Jackie is playing Master Wu, who looks like a Chinese, but is training Americans who are nominally doing a Japanese style, so it's kind of messy and ridiculous, but what are you going to do? Jackie is there. Jackie is doing his darndest to make this entertaining, and he brought along one of the top guys from his Jackie Chan stuntman team, Wu Gong, and they try to choreograph cool Lego fight scenes and take advantage of the limited form to do some interesting things, but the film keeps undercutting them, keeps making the fight short, and literally washes Jackie's character, Master Wu, off the screen after like 8 or 10 minutes, and he doesn't come back. Instead, we get more of the father-son plot, the unfunny, uninteresting, uninvolving father-son plot. There is one other thing I'm loath to reveal, but since I really don't want you to see this movie because it kind of sucks and is super disappointing and at least dull and, whatever, and many other negative words, Jackie, at the beginning, he plays the quintessential character in an old secret Asian store that's all smoky and dusty and that only the lead little kid can find. It's like, you know, Gremlins, where he gives out Gremlins, except now he's going to give this little kid these little Lego figures to make him feel better about being bullied by a variety of a-holes around him. But in any case, Jackie has a cat in that store who he doesn't like and who scratches him. And it's a cool cat. And the cat turns out to be the main monster in the movie. When the villain, the father villain, unleashes a monster onto, actually through his son's stupidity, unleashes a monster onto the land of Ninjago, it turns out to be a live-action cat. And that's pretty cool. And that's about it. So if you want to hang around for the 2 minutes the cat is on, then you're more than welcome to. Oh, gosh. Glad that's over. Now, let's go to a really good movie. And that is Blade Runner 2049, directed by Denis Villeneuve. I'm not pronouncing that right. My French friends will pronounce that. My friend Caroline Vier and Jean-Marc Toussaint, off in Paris, are yelling at the podcast going, "That's not how to pronounce his name, you idiot!" But I can pronounce the names of the screenwriters, and that's Hampton Fancher. Maybe I can't pronounce it. He's better known as a TV actor than he is a writer, but he worked on the original Blade Runner. And the other screenwriter is Michael Green, who's written for the American Gods television show. He also wrote the screenplays for Logan and Green Lantern, which I wish I could connect up to The Foreigner, which is the return of Jackie Chan in a live-action role. The movie is almost, I think, 2 years old, but they've recut it, and they're releasing it as I'm recording this, they're releasing it like a day before we're posting this. So I'm not able to get to it before I leave, and I apologize for that. I wanted to get to it, but circumstances beyond my and anyone else's control has kept me from going there. But I bring that up because after Green Lantern, Martin Campbell, who directed GoldenEye and Casino Royale, arguably two of the best, not, I don't even think it's arguable, two of the best James Bond movies, and maybe the best James Bond movies outside of, say, like From Russia with Love or something, was thrown under the bus rather aggressively after he directed Green Lantern and it failed miserably. And the word I get on the street is that it was far from his fault. It had a lot to do with interference from the studio, just as the failure of Man of Steel and Batman v Superman were, as far as I'm told, largely the responsibility of interfering executives. But they decided that Martin Campbell was the guy to blame for Green Lantern. So he's coming back with The Foreigner. He's also just a great director and a good TV guy, so more power to him. But anyway, that's the connection that I bring it up and interrupt my discussion of Blade Runner 2049. The stunt coordinator on Blade Runner 2049 is Joel Kramer, who worked on Westworld and Star Trek Discovery, and Mike Massa, who worked on the TV version of Powers, is the co-stunt coordinator. And it's interesting because no fight coordinator is credited on IMDb, and I didn't pay enough attention during the 80 minutes of credits at the end of this film to see if I could find a fight coordinator credited, but he's not credited on IMDb, which is a shame. Since the fights are fairly effective and credible for the most part, up to a point. I'm not one of these critics who's going to tell you the whole plot. I will say that this is an awesome movie. It is a movie. It's one of my favorite kind of movies in that it's a movie. It's a movie like much of Christopher Nolan's work that requires a movie screen and a movie experience, and it's designed specifically for the movie experience, and it's not going to be nearly as good on the back of your seat in the plane or on your iPad or whatever. It is an immersive, engrossing, involving, challenging cinematic experience. And I knew they were in trouble when I went on the first show of the first night and I was essentially alone in the theater. So I was not surprised when it didn't have a great first weekend. In fact, I was not surprised even before I saw there was nobody in the cinema except me, because the original Blade Runner didn't have anybody in the cinema on the first day. The original 2001, when it came out, didn't have a huge audience. These are movies that will stand the test of time because they're great, not because they're popular. And the fact that the studio and the press are, you know, are running around with their hands in the air and their hair on fire, throwing papers around because it didn't have a good first weekend, I certainly didn't think it would. It didn't before, so why would it now? Anyway, but be that as it may, it's an amazing movie. It's almost 3 hours long. It doesn't seem 3 hours to me, but even if it did seem like 3 hours, it's 3 hours well spent. It's a great work of art. However, this, you know what this podcast is called. So, again, I wanted to find the fight coordinator, because the fights, when they started, were pretty good. They were credible. They weren't, you know, ridiculous roundhouse punches. They were believable in if you were a robot or an android or a Blade Runner who was created by someone else to take out other Blade Runners. They understood where their weaknesses, where their opponent's weakness was, and they played on that. They didn't spend any time trying to prove how badass they were. They were just trying to get their job done. So the fighting was pretty good. Matter of fact, I kind of perked up at the first fight. I went, oh, okay, they're just doing what is effective. I don't know if I've taught you kung fu on this podcast before, but in my kind of kung fu, I am not interested how tough you are. I'm interested how smart you are. I'm not interested how badass you are or how badass you're trying to prove yourself to be. I'm interested in how effective you are in succeeding, not winning, succeeding and learning. So it seemed that's what was happening here, and that was super cool. However, I'll read what I wrote down. The fights are fairly effective and credible, for the most part, up to a point. I did repeat that. This is a repetition. Now I'll stop repeating and say something else. And that point is in the last third of the film, where suddenly the action that was logical and understandable, short, effective, and to the point, becomes increasingly nonsensical and flamboyant for some reason. Harrison Ford's Deckard makes fists and does repeated roundhouse punches, but they've already established that he is a Blade Runner and he's not a human. He's created to fight other Blade Runners. They created that in the director's cut of the original, and they reestablished that here. So why? Maybe John Wayne programmed him to fight. So suddenly he's making fists, one of the least effective things you can do, and doing roundhouse punches. Okay, all right, fine. But then Ryan Gosling, who's a much further along the line android Blade Runner, his character's known as Kay, once Ryan Gosling meets Deckard, he breaks his previous effective, smart, and practical fighting style by doing, it comes out of nowhere, he's fighting these guys who are trying to kill him and the Harrison Ford character, and he suddenly does a World Wrestling Federation style power slam on a guy. And I'm going, what? I mean, if you've ever seen a power slam, it has a lot of wasted motion. And up until then, he wasn't wasting motion, but suddenly he starts wasting motion. Now, the movie is such that may have been purposeful. I can't figure out why. Maybe Harrison Ford's character has infected him. But in any case, I wouldn't be surprised if I got to talk to the director that he would say, oh yeah, I did that for a reason, and the reason is this. For now, I can't understand the reason. But it gets worse. The weirdest is saved the climactic confrontation between the really cruel, sadistic female enforcer of the really cruel, sadistic, megalomaniacal villain played by Jared Leto, who basically is not fulfilled here. He looks like a sequel character. He shows up, he does some really horrible things, then he disappears from the movie, and there's no ending of his story. There's no effective and satisfying ending to the villain's story. Okay. But anyway, this sadistic female enforcer, who's known as Love, L-U-V, that's what she was named by Jared Leto, she seeks to defeat Gosling's character by doing multiple repeated spinning back kicks in the ocean surf to him. And that's pretty weird enough, because I had a discussion with a mixed martial arts guy who was really proud of his spinning back kick. And I said, when would you ever use a spinning back kick effectively? He said, well, there are moments that I'm saying there are at least, right off the top of my head, there are at least 3 to 6 that I can, other things you can do in that circumstance that would be more effective and less, and make you less vulnerable and make and work better than doing a spinning back kick. But she does repeat it in the surf because they're doing sort of a rebirth sequence in the movie. You'll see it if you go see the movie, which I recommend you do. But she's doing spinning back kick, spinning back kick, spinning back kick, and that's bad enough. But worse, Gosling's character, to no one's credit, just stands there and takes the kicks. The spinning back kick is super, super easy to avoid, number one. You can go up, down, sideways, over. And it's also super easy to counter because as they're doing the spinning part, you move in. So, you know, you're right next to them by the time their leg comes around and down they go, and you can do whatever you want to their heads and necks and kidneys and ribs at any time. But he just stands there and takes it over and over and over again until I'm sitting there going, this is really stupid. You know, it might be, again, since Jen and Miko aren't here to tell me what they thought of it, it might even become really stupid to audience members other than me. I mean, but we're still not done with the problem. Even that is not quite as bad as the ultimate Friday the 13th-like eruption. Kay is supposedly killed by these, or put out for the count, or drowned by these multiple spinning back kicks. But then, just as it seems that this terrible, sadistic, awful android person will kill Harrison Ford, he erupts from under the surf, Friday the 13th-like, back from the seemingly dead to choke the female enforcer to death. But again, it ultimately becomes stupid because in return, the female enforcer basically just lets him do that. For the rest of the movie, she has been sadistic and cruel and effective in her killing of people. But here, the filmmakers show her hands scrambling on Gosling's chest and shoulders, trying to stop him. He just had this one solid arm clutched on her throat, much like her spinning back kick, her one leg in the spinning back kick. But rather than do what you would think she would have done on the basis of the killing she's done before, she would have taken her fingers, she would have plunged them into either her thumbs or her forefingers, she would have plunged them into Gosling's eye until she hit bone. But no, here she's just scrambling, 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 and he's nope, didn't happen. So it didn't ruin the movie for me, but it did make me wonder. It made me wonder why the filmmakers would choose to do that. But they did. So I forgive it, but I'm telling you, had they kept up their previous action themes and effectiveness, it would have made for a much better movie. No, wait a minute, that's not true. Not a much better. It's a great film. It's a great movie. It's just that, unfortunately, the movie happened to stumble into the barroom named Action Film Autopsy and met Professor Rick, who was standing behind the bar. And Professor Rick is going, what are you doing with those roundhouse kicks and that Friday the 13th neck grabbing? What is up with that? So anyway, we could talk about other things like the two American movies that came out, American Assassin and American Maid, but I'll be honest, I didn't see them. Hopefully in a couple of weeks or in about a month when we come back to the more recent critical episodes, I'll tell you why I didn't see those two movies. It's not important. It's just, I didn't really need to see them. But that's it. I've almost talked for an hour. I'm such a blabbermouth. So let me wrap up. I'm going to ask you to do, as I've been asking the last couple of episodes, that after I finish my sign-off, you shout out, chew your food, Rick. I recently had a dental removal. I had an extraction of a dying tooth. And I learned once again that chewing my food is super important. But even that terrible experience, shocking experience, hasn't gotten me to do it. So I need you, after I do my upcoming sign-off, to shout out, chew your food, Rick. And somehow, I am certain I will hear you. So, until next time, when I'm here, and hopefully you're there to hear what we're talking about, hopefully with Jen and Miko next time, use your blinkers, jackass! Chew your food, Rick!
Okay, break it up, break it up! For now,
you don't give up, do you?
Listen in next time for more film fun, frenzy, and friends. Until then,
a real fight.
Check out actionfilmautopsy.com, where the excitement never ends.
Sonic Victory.